yes, Bitcoin can die. And if Bitcoin fails to get some level of mass adoption soon enough, I believe it will die. Governments all around the world gave us 14 years of advantage to try to get Bitcoin to become this money, medium of exchange, store of value thing, or at least an investment vehicle or savings technology that is super valuable and with widespread ownership. But now, it is starting to move. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we've got a great one today. We are continuing in our article series, our back and forth with a number of different people. I'm writing on this topic of drive chains, side chains, and it's essentially the scope of the problem of trying to get a billion people directly using Bitcoin and having the sovereignty and independence that Bitcoin enables. How do we scale this from a million people being able to get that benefit to everyone being able to get that benefit so that it brings freedom to the world, not just some small subset? Now, I want to preface this because I disagree with a lot of this article, and we'll talk about it in the guy's take. But this one is by Fiat Jaff, who is a ardent proponent of drive chains. And I want to preface this with just saying that I have a ton of respect for Fiat Jaff, and I hope he doesn't get offended by my disagreement. I really value his opinion, and he is a builder like no other. And I tend to put Fiat Jaff in that category. There's like this group of people, specifically in like Bitcoiners, who are just really unapologetic about the way they see things. And I find that insanely valuable, even when I disagree with them. It's funny, I think of Shinobi as kind of like the person on the other side. Like, Shinobi is so vehemently against drive chains and some of this mindset. So all of that is to say that I actually really appreciate that Fiat Jaff jumped into this thread, so to speak, and gave his input. So with that, let's just go ahead and jump into it. This show is brought to you by our amazing sponsors. We have Nodeless.io, which is how you can plug your online life into Bitcoin, accept Bitcoin with donations, online store, with your project, anything. It's just simple. It's easy. It takes almost no time at all. There's no KYC. They have a powerful API, and all payments just go straight or just forwarded straight to you. I got a link in the show notes for you to check them out. And of course, Fold, the debit card that pays you sats back on everything in your life. I do not know of an easier way to just stack a ton of sats. It's putting the Fold card and the Fold app at the center of your fiat life. It is literally one of the best things I've done to get an extra stream of sats from doing all the same things that I always did. And you can get 100,000 sats for free just for signing up at my link. And then you can get 9% off the cold card so that you can send all of those sats there. Nodeless, they'll send it directly. You'll accept Bitcoin for your product and it will go straight to your cold card. Stack sats with fold card, send it to your cold card. It is a super secure, versatile hardware wallet that will just protect your keys just so that you know you own it and you can sleep easy at night. And a 9% discount is nothing to scoff at. So check out the link, check out the discount code. All of this stuff is in the show notes. With that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, The Place of Drive Chain in Bitcoin's Future by Fiat Jaff. James O'Byrne wrote this nice little article that contains a bunch of statements that should have been obvious to anyone who thought a little about Bitcoin's future, as they were obvious for Hal Finney in 2009 already. Basically, the article says that the Bitcoin blockchain won't scale for the entire world population to use it. It will so much not scale that even off-chain solutions like Lightning and Arc will not scale, and they basically lose usefulness as more adoption happens and fees rise. Given that, Bitcoin has only two paths. Now this is not James speaking anymore. Either it will die, or it will have to scale using custodians. Can Bitcoin die? Yes, Bitcoin can die. And if Bitcoin fails to get some level of mass adoption soon enough, I believe it will die. Governments all around the world gave us 14 years of advantage to try to get Bitcoin to become this money, medium of exchange, store of value thing, or at least an investment vehicle or savings technology that is super valuable and with widespread ownership. But now it is starting to move. CBDCs have been talked about for a while, but now they are really starting to happen. Regulated and compliant fiat proprietary services like Venmo have grown under capture by governments. In some places, the government itself has launched their own cool, app-like, totally regulated spyware fiat money transmission things, like the ridiculous Pix in Brazil, which is now widely adopted, and I believe surprisingly for all the UX designers out there, people have learned to use QR codes. The point is that given a little bit of more time, governments can start to encroach on Bitcoin space, making it more and more regulated until it either dies or becomes a very useless thing. Some Bitcoiners think Bitcoin has already won. This can't be further from the truth. Others think Bitcoin must not be mass adopted. It must stay as this niche and mostly useless currency digital asset thing, or I don't really understand what they think. These people are wrong. There are also people who think Bitcoin should not be used by normal people as money. It should keep being adopted, but only as a store of value. This is also completely wrong, since Bitcoin's value tends to decrease as soon as owners realize Bitcoin is losing its chances of becoming actual money. Scaling. To not die, Bitcoin must become more used. The current thesis accepted by most maximalists, quote-unquote, is that Bitcoin will continue to be thought of as an investment, and its price will keep increasing. The price movements will bring more attention to it in a virtuous cycle. Eventually, enough people will want to hold it so that they will start accepting it as a payment for goods and services, and then it can start to be used as money. Assuming that will happen, we'll be faced with a problem. As people try to use it as money, they will necessarily, by lack of other options, have to use some custodial solution, or some proto-custodial solution, maybe using Lightning as a settlement layer between big custodians, I don't know. No one is happy with that solution, and rightfully so, since it is very dangerous. A small set of custodians can easily be captured by governments, and they can slowly turn Bitcoin into fiat money like they did with gold. In other words, without DriveChain, Bitcoin will be a fragile success in the best case, and dead in the worst case scenario. Enter DriveChain. DriveChain basically brings two things to the table. In the best case scenario of the non-DriveChain world, we would be in a fragile position with easily capturable custodians. With DriveChain, we can create a bunch of decentralized sidechains, backed by the same mining process that is assumed to be decentralized already for Bitcoin to even work. And we gain orders of magnitude of more room to make censorship-resistant, open transactions that don't require tax IDs or selfies and can't be stopped or regulated by governments. Bitcoin can scale as it normally would, but it's much more resilient. The other thing we get are improvements for the, quote, dying part. If DriveChain is successful, it may end up bringing much more people to Bitcoin. HiveMind by itself may attract lots of users and capital that has been prevented from betting on predictions anywhere in the fiat world since always. Zcash or Monero sidechains can easily bring all the, quote, cryptocurrency enthusiasts that care about privacy and have long ago decided that Bitcoin isn't for them. These people are interested in some immediate feature that now Bitcoin can provide them with. Other sidechains, like Ethereum-like chains, can also contribute to slowly bringing in some of the users of these chains. Why would we want these people to come to Bitcoin? Because they will increase Bitcoin's network effect, increase the Satoshi price, and these changes would contribute for more people to start looking at Bitcoin and using Bitcoin, and so on and so forth. More users, more network effect, bigger price will contribute to Bitcoin not being easily regulated and killed by governments. In other words, with DriveChain, Bitcoin will be a resilient success in the worst case and a complete and total world dominator money in the best case. Footnotes. Number 1. On using Lightning as settlement between big custodians. I actually think Bitcoiners should put more thought onto how to create a custodian network that scales easily without having to be centralized in a small set of providers like Lightning is, and this is kind of the point of James's article too. Footnote 2. Yes, I do think the entirety of the Ethereum ecosystem is a waste of time and money, but clearly there are dozens of people and money that disagree with me. And if they can't harm me with their stupidity, then they will definitely make our money stronger. Besides that, it's not as if there aren't already many stupid people, or even evil, horrible criminals, using Bitcoin. This episode is brought to you by Nodeless.io. If you want to be sovereign, and you want to hold your own keys, and you want to integrate your online world with accepting Bitcoin payments for your products, or your charity, or a project that you're working on, but you just don't have the time or want to deal with the hassle of setting up your own cloud node and BTC pay server and managing channels and all that mess, this is literally why Nodeless was built. Nodeless was built for you to make this process simple, to receive payments online that get sent directly to your cold storage or your Lightning wallet. As someone who can even do those other things, I am still switching over to Nodeless because it's just easy and it works. And it costs me just 1% and all of that complexity just disappears. It's like magic. Plus, there's no KYC. You don't have to deal with identity verification or any of that crap that usually comes with some sort of service. You just go there, sign up with an email, and plug your online store into it. And actually, if you set up a donation page, it takes, 30 seconds. I will actually be your first donation. Send me the page showing that you set it up and I'll zap you 10,000 sats for fun. Just please don't drain me of all of my sats, but I will try to do as many as I can. And don't forget to use my link. It is right there in the show notes, bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless. All right, now this, I would probably say this seems more Fiat Jaff's personality, but he's kind of absolutist in this article. And generally really pessimistic. And we talked about this from with James O'Byrne's article yesterday, that I think there are really a lot of crucial caveats as to why a Bitcoin future, even with the semi-custodial sort of federated models and where Bitcoin acts as a kind of last resort adjudicator, even one that is prohibitively expensive in the, you know, sub-$1,000 range, is still actually a drastic improvement over the situation as it stands today. And I think it's crucial because we're talking about a limitation that is inherent to blockchains. And, you know, Fiat Jaff has clearly seems to think that drive chains are this kind of like all-in-one solution that solves the major problem. So when we were talking about in the general sidechains episodes, or actually maybe it was the actual drive chain episode, the read from BitMEX, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember which one. We've done like 4 episodes on this already. But I talked about if there was essentially the holy grail of scaling, which would be a means of pegging in and pegging out of a semi-custodial or semi-trusted relationship in which there was a non-cooperative, a non-interactive ongoing updates of the sidechain and a non-interactive exit from that chain or from that pool or sidechain, whatever you want to call it, back to the main chain that did not require explicit cooperation from the operator of the chain or the operator of the side pool system. We're just going to use the word, the thing that James O'Byrne used in the last episode for simplicity. We're just going to call it coin pool. And this just is a generic idea that will cover drive chains, Fediment, Liquid, anything like that, aside from Lightning, which is its own, obviously, individual one-to-one thing. But one of the things I said in yesterday's episode was that the idea of just increasing the block size, I think, is not only not a solution, it's basically admitting defeat. It's basically saying that there isn't a solution and all we can do is make the system, it's the layer one, bigger until no one can run it, which is just falling right back into the same centralized incentives, economies of scale, feedback loop where the more centralized it is, the better it operates. If we're using layer one as essentially the payment layer. Now, obviously, the interaction that we've gotten used to the behavior of layer one, of this reliable means of just sending it straight to a UTXO, having an address that is ours, and then opening up a channel. Like, you know, Lightning does that 10x, maybe even 100x over the base layer capacity or volume. But in the context of the scaling problem of getting 1 billion, 2 billion or more people using this as their fundamental, as their main monetary network, even stretching Lightning to its limitations is you know, barely a drop in the bucket. But that also sort of suggests that 100 megabyte blocks and, you know, a gigabyte in an hour is also pretty much inconsequential in the realm of actually achieving the scaling that we're talking about, while it would clearly be profoundly detrimental to the decentralization of the underlying network and the ability to audit and actually keep this thing, actually validate the supply cap. Now, I know that Fiat Jaff wasn't really taking this article to kind of explain any of the nuances of DriveChain. I mean, there's not really any explanation of DriveChain. It's just kind of his answer to this thread of thinking that if we have DriveChain, you know, going back to my example of looking for that holy grail of the peg in, peg out, it seems to me that both Fiat Jaff and Paul Storks and a number of other people actually think that DriveChain is that holy grail. While I do think it could be an addition to the suite of tools or models that we have at our disposal right now, I think it is very, very far from the holy grail. And in fact, when I think about the security model of having miners vote, and that the vote of the miner is only even relevant if they are doing the validation of the drive chain, I don't really see how the underlying security is actually any better than just raising the block size from the context of onboarding people onto the drive chain. So I want to defend that statement really quick and make sure that I'm also understanding drive chain properly, because I definitely have read a lot of things that were actually incorrect about drive chain that I've come to try to work my way around finding the actual true details in the mix. So I'll give the details that I think are necessary to understand my thinking on this. So activating a new drive chain is essentially a minor soft fork, in the sense that, not necessarily that, you know, we're changing core client and everybody needs to upgrade, so to speak, but that at least everybody who's not using the sidechain, but that there is a new type of transaction specifically for that sidechain that all miners need to recognize. And if more than half the miners are not recognizing it or not blind merged mining it, then it opens itself up to a lot of security issues or potential censoring of the peg out. But if any of the miners actually want to vote on the peg out in order to grant it that security or the benefit of the miners actually voting for the correct owners rather than, you know, stealing or preventing some malicious miner from stealing, then they need to be running a validating node for the sidechain. Now, there's one benefit that between the gap of the last sidechain, or the last like peg out or settling, the time lock, like, right, there's like a 3-month time lock and then like six month challenging period. I can't remember exactly the thing, but we'll just use 6 months for simplicity, because I know that's like one of the longest time periods in which something can be challenged or fixed if something goes wrong. So 6 months back, you essentially can ignore its history. So it's not quite like Bitcoin in the fact that you need its history all the way back to Genesis in order to validate rightful ownership and the correct monetary policy of the chain, because you always have Bitcoin to fall back on. However, if the vote is basically meaningless unless the miner is validating the sidechain, and we've got 10 and we want, you know, the miners, you know, voting on or providing hash power to secure as many of the sidechains as possible, we want more than half for essentially all of the sidechains or drive chains. And we've got 10 huge drive chains, and we're all trying to do the UTXO model and just do blockchains differently then it seems to kind of mean to me that there is no real sovereignty gain from any of these sidechains unless all the miners are mining for all the sidechains and running validating nodes for all of them, which essentially equates to everything outside of the Bitcoin chain being like having gigameg blocks. Now, I do get that that risk is divided, and it's largely isolated to the people on the sidechain, or on the drive chain. But the thing is that we're literally talking about a scenario in which we're trying to onboard everyone into drive chains. So I just don't think it's so simple as, well, we trust that the miners are decentralized, and therefore these sidechains would be secure. Because in my mind, the holy grail of the peg in and peg out is that the keys remain the proof of ownership, whether or not you're on the drive chain or the side chain or the coin pool or whatever. And if you go back to Bitcoin, the keys are still what determine ownership, whether or not you're going to batch it or you're going to coin join or you're going to be in a single UTXO that's actually shared by 100 different people, that it's not some vote or some rough amount of hash power that determines whether or not you own this balance or not. It's that at the end of the day, your keys are the ones that can move it in validly in the UTXO set on the fundamental, on the base layer Bitcoin chain, and that we want to extend the key system, not the hash system, because what you do is essentially you lose the fact that the key and the address itself and its kind of proof of history are the ownership model, and you turn it over to the amount of hash rate is determining who owns what, with a standard blockchain key system as kind of a point of reference for what the miners should be doing, for determining whether or not the miner is being honest, but not that they can't contest that, but simply that we could see if they challenged what is quote-unquote the valid ownership. So in my mind, drive chains are just a different way of doing this that kind of have a bigger hurdle to achieve that I don't think have any massive outsized benefit. Like, there is a benefit and a potential upside, but I genuinely think it kind of comes with the risk of all the other models that we have. You know, if you think about it, like Liquid, is that, let's say we have 100 globally distributed, federated signers for something like the Liquid sidechain. Well, you have some sort of an actual trusted benefit in the sense that you know someone can't come out of nowhere and kind of muscle out those 100 signers. So you kind of know the relationship you're getting into. And maybe you're aware that the U.S. is a very malicious jurisdiction, that you can't trust the 10 signers in the U.S. Or Russia is one that you just kind of know that the 7 signers in Russia could go offline or something like that. So you can kind of make some sort of a trust assessment with the pool of signers. Whereas when you're talking about hash power is permissionless. Anyone can come out of nowhere with just a mountain of hash power and dominate the network. Not saying that that's going to happen, but I'm saying that there's actually a potential downside to the fact that it's kind of a hash power multi-sig. So you actually don't know who is participating in the multi-sig, but your keys still aren't what determines ownership. It is the degree of hash power voting for what the proper history of the drive chain is. Whereas Bitcoin isn't that. The hash power is simply there to make the history extremely difficult to modify, but it doesn't change ownership. You can't undo somebody's signature or undo a balance going to one specific person. So the holy grail of sidechain is that the key remains the ownership on the sidechain and the base layer. And the peg in and peg out are both determined or enabled by the user. So if the entire sidechain goes away, even if it's expensive, the user can always go back to the main chain and figure out some way to get their part of the tap tree or whatever the hell it is into a Bitcoin UTXO on the base layer. Now, obviously, there's no perfect solution to this. And obviously, if we're talking about $1,000 transaction fees at some, you know, proposed future point, that's a pretty steep cost to go to an adjudicator. But like I argued in the last episode, I think there's very, very good reason to argue that this is still actually a revolutionary improvement over the fiat system that we have today from multiple different levels. So I encourage you to listen to the guy's take of yesterday's episode to hit those points, but I'll just kind of refresh them really quick, kind of with a sentence. Is one, this still means that at the end of the day, there's a $1,000 barrier to any degree of economic capital to essentially prove inflation resistance. If you always have, ARK is a good example, right? Is that you can always go back on chain. Liquid is not, because you have to actually trust the Federation to let you peg out. But if we have more of a kind of CTV sort of coin pool ARK like construction, where even if it's having to unroll a branch of a tap script or something in order to prove your ownership, but you can still always go back to the base layer, this will still relegate systemic inflation to the history books, because you will always still be able to run a fully validating node on Bitcoin. And if the overwhelming majority of capital can still, and I mean that in the economic sense, like if every business or community or, you know, family trust could essentially pay $1,000 to essentially have an inflation rug insurance plan, so to speak. You pre-purchased some sort of fee or put in some sort of stake in order to buy the block space if the shit ever hit the fan. That is still otherworldly in comparison to what we have today. Now, the second thing is that the base layer is still permissionless, which means there's no limitation on who can provide these services. You know, talking about the idea of like, oh, if it's just a few big custodians, well, governments can just control them. Well, the control actually comes at the regulatory level, at the licensing level. The fact that they have an insanely walled garden, closed and permissioned apparatus for even allowing someone to get a Federal Reserve account, that you can even interact with the system. I use the example of like, start with $1 million, and how difficult is it for anyone, for any of you listening to me right now, to get a bank charter and plug yourself into the Federal Reserve system so that you can provide any sort of financial or payment services to anybody? Will $1 million do that? Can you do it with just $1 million? Can you do it in the absence of some political connection or knowing the right person, like having a regulator in your pocket? I'd argue that that's not really going to get you very far. You need a lot more than just $1 million in capital. Whereas if you're operating, if you're participating in a Fedimint or operating a coin pool or an ARK or anything like that, that's totally permissionless. You need a UTXO. So in a world where $1,000 is the rough, you know, the crazy fee of this insanely valuable system, because we do have 1 billion people on it and we need all of these constructs and these side chains interoperating with Lightning and all of this stuff. Well, that means it's $1,000 to literally become a global, completely censorship resistant service provider to anyone in the world. And anyone in the world can accept that service from, again, anywhere, anyone, and at any location on the planet. We still literally have a global censorship-resistant, inflation-proof base, technological base, open protocol to operate these things from. And then the other one was just the idea of, if you had a court system that was perfect. Imagine you had a court system that was perfect, and no matter what, the proper owner of any supposed theft was always going to get if they got through the court system, the proper owner was always going to receive the funds, and the perpetrator was always going to be the one who was punished, and there was no ability to corrupt the fundamental system and how it worked, but only like 0.5% of the population could get through at any one time, and it cost $1,000 to go through the court. Again, in comparison to the court system and the pain and the staggering cost of going through the court system today, this would seem like a perfect world in comparison. So the way I think about this potential of what Bitcoin actually looks like when we have 1 billion users, and the downside of having a bunch of semi-custodial federated trust sort of relationships, is that federated trust and semi-custodial relationships have never been possible before. Like, this, that is a new thing. And it should not be discounted that that's an order of magnitude improvement. That's a revolutionary improvement over what we have to deal with today. We're like custodial on top of permission token. And I do not think in my digging into why gold became fiat, that I do not see the most important flaws where like large custodians or large service providers end up turning Bitcoin into the new gold just on the internet. Because I think one of the number one reasons gold became fiat is the geographic restriction, is that you can't trade gold peer-to-peer with someone anywhere else in the world. You have to do it in your physical location. And it's not just that it got centralized in custodians, it's that it specifically got centralized in single custodians because there's no multi-sig in gold. And even more specifically, that single custodian was always in your jurisdiction, which means that you couldn't have a gold service provider in China if you lived in the US. You can do that on a permissionless decentralized base on a global digital network. So all of this is to say that obviously, as we all are perfectly aware of, blockchains don't scale. They never did. But I don't think that a bunch of different blockchains, all secured by the same miners that lose that property of your keys or your coins, and instead the real ownership is determined by vote of the miners, so that we just have a ton of different blockchains as opposed to one blockchain that we're trying to scale, necessarily, I think it just kind of puts the problem in a different place. Now, I went in a little bit more detail in yesterday's Guy's Take as to why I think the economic majority, why essentially the high balance people or the high balances and economic majority in these sidechain systems or the coin pool systems, if everyone has the ability to exit, that they essentially subsidize the security game theory of everyone who is underneath the fee threshold. Now, it's not obviously not some sort of perfect system, but I think it's actually a lot more nuanced than simply if you have less than $1,000, then you don't own anything, anybody can just take it from you. If we're talking about obviously the proposed future where all on-chain fees are $1,000. But this will actually kind of be relevant again when we read Alex's piece tomorrow, so I won't belabor the point again here. So I want to hit a quote from this article. It says, this section says, given a little bit of more time, governments can start to encroach on Bitcoin space, making it more and more regulated until it either dies or becomes a very useless thing. Some Bitcoiners think Bitcoin has already won. This can't be further from the truth. Others think Bitcoin must not be mass adopted. It must stay as this niche and mostly useless currency digital asset thing, or I don't really understand what they think. These people are wrong. There are also people who think Bitcoin should not be used by normal people as money. It should keep being adopted, but only as a store of value. This is also completely wrong, since Bitcoin's value tends to decrease as soon as owners realize Bitcoin is losing its chances to becoming actual money. Now, this section also in reference, pointing out that just before he says, talking about CBDCs and, you know, kind of the encroaching, we're going to take over the digital asset or the digital payments space with this new technology that takes all the worst parts or takes some of the parts of what makes Bitcoin technology, makes the blockchain technology the blockchain, and then makes it the absolute worst, most totalitarian, surveillance, centralized version of that that you could possibly come up with. And he starts it with saying governments all around the world gave us 14 years of advantage to try to get Bitcoin to become this money, medium of exchange, store of value thing. Now, the longer I have been here and the more I've read about monetary history and kind of dug into these things. And also, let's use the example of if we had drive chains, I really don't think we would be in a very different place than we are today. And I don't think it's a technological problem. Well, obviously there is a technological problem. There is a technological limitation to the adoption in multiple regards. However, I do not think that is the major limiting factor. I genuinely think monetary transitions are just really, really difficult. Like, historically, the idea of a monetary shift happening in a 14-year period is really kind of crazy. Like, even in the fiat world, they take 20 to 30 years. And that's with essentially a government superpower backing the transition, in the sense that when the dominant fiat, it's essentially the dominant empire being adopted as the most trusted credit token. But if you go back to natural monies, if you go back to the sound money eras and look at commodity monies being adopted, this is why I talk about this from a lot of different angles and many, many times on the show, is that there is a, seems to be a clear store of value to medium of exchange to unit of account transition. And you can't skip steps and you can't go out of order. And it is not a fast process, and it's not a technological process either. It's a mental shift. It's a cultural and social shift. It's akin to watching the dominant language shift in a society. And then when we're talking about bringing in the Ethereum people and the privacy, the Monero and Zcash privacy coin community and all of that stuff, like, of course there would be a net benefit to just having a bigger network, without a doubt. Like, nobody should, arguing against that, I think, is just kind of silly on its face. Fiat Jaff is right that the more people we have on Bitcoin, regardless of the level of their devotion or understanding, the economic game theory works better with more people and more value. It just does. However, I do not think the idea of, if we had drive chains in 2014, that means that Ethereum and all the altcoins and stuff would not have had the adoption that they have. I don't really think that's the case. Like, the reason there was this massive explosion of just new coin after new coin after new coin was because, the overwhelming adopter and push for that entire flood happening was buy coin cheap, price go up. It was the idea of recreating the getting a Bitcoin at 10 cent and selling it at $1,000. That was the reason for 99% of it. And as much as I want all of the privacy coin people, all the people who genuinely care about and want to use one of these systems for the privacy gains, for the fact that we could have genuinely private cypherpunk-like money, that I would essentially love to have everyone with that mindset wholly on to Bitcoin, I also don't think that's a huge driver. Most people, for whatever it is, just the reality of it is most people don't give a shit about that. I wish they did. I really wish they did. Monero, which is a decent privacy technology, only has like a $2 billion market cap. And I still think a lot of that is just people betting the fact that it's going to go up in price. But let's say it's all people who genuinely care about, it's just 100% cypherpunks. I think it's probably like 30% cypherpunks, 70% people token go up. Maybe I'm wrong. There's a ton of people I know who are Monero supporters who seem to genuinely care. Like Seth for Privacy, I have mad respect for that guy. But yank all of that market cap and you've stick it onto Bitcoin, you've got almost nothing. We go from what, $500 billion to $502 billion. Like, it doesn't make a dent. Like, we moved that much in the last day. And even if we took all the 1 million plus tokens out there, all of them, and pushed them all, everybody came back to Bitcoin, which I think is a fantasy. I think even with drive chains, even with the full, like, some sort of Turing complete but still super secure Bitcoin system, I think the overwhelming majority of those tokens exist because I get to issue them for nothing and sell them for $100. And you can't do that on Bitcoin after Bitcoin is already 5 years old, 10 years old. But let's assume we could. Let's assume we could essentially eliminate the entire thing. Then that literally makes Bitcoin like 80% bigger than it is today. And I honestly think there's only like 5 or 10% that's legit, that wouldn't be here without the speculation. And I say that as someone who tries to explain and talks to crypto people, and they're just certain that they're, and it's when I was even in the shitcoin space, when I did shitcoining in 2017, all I gave a shit about was whether or not that price was going to go up. I was just gambling. I was gambling to get more Bitcoin. Now, the one caveat about drive chains that would be amazing in the regards to how its model works is that it does enable you to essentially create any of them. So if there is legitimate liquidity or there is legitimate interest, like, for example, say if XMR, if Monero has literally $2 billion market cap of genuine use case, well, you could essentially stamp that use case on top of Bitcoin fully and completely with drive chains. So I'm not discounting it completely. I'm just saying it's no magic bullet, and I do not think it would be some night and day difference between what we have now and what it would have been had we already had drive chains. And that's really just kind of ignoring the fact that I think it's not the holy grail of the peg out, because, I mean, not only just for the huge time delay, which obviously you can have liquidity services and you can, you know, peg in and out with Lightning or whatever, atomic swaps, like you can always figure that out. That's not really that big of a deal in the context of the user. You'd be able to get in and out of the drive chain quick, even though there's this supposed 3-month wait. But going back to my earlier point, I think we're still ignoring the fact that I think it's a rather significant trade-off that the peg out model is dependent on miner votes and that the keys are not the determinant of ownership. And then relying on validation nodes to user-activated soft fork to basically have an active community that is essentially constantly defending the main chain from malicious pegouts or malicious settlement of a drive chain, I do not think is a reliable security model. I think user-activated soft fork was a bit of an anomaly at the time, and it's a powerful tool, but it's kind of a last resort tool. It's not something that when anything goes wrong, we have to immediately jump to a user-activated soft fork. I think that's really messy, and that's kind of what I said after the drive chain episode with the BitMEX piece. And obviously, that's a oversimplification of the kind of dynamic there, and you would want, you know, other honest miners to come in. But you're just right back to the validation problem. And there's also an element too that if there is a large malicious miner that jumps in and kind of wants to be part of the quote unquote hash rate multisig of a drive chain, and then maliciously try to steal from, you know, drive chain number one. Well, the thing is that if honest miners are supposed to defend, well, then the honest miners still need to validate, and all the nodes relevant to that sidechain, to drive chain number one, still need to validate and know that that miner is in fact being malicious and trying to steal coins that don't belong to them during the peg out. However, there's another element at play that, because we're blind merged mining, the attacker can do this on drive chain 2, drive chain 3, drive chain 4, drive chain 5, all the way to drive chain 21 at the exact same time, because that same hash rate can be applied to all the various chains. It's kind of like, it's a little bit like the dynamic of the nothing at stake problem, where a staker can create as many alternative histories as they want. Well, the malicious miner doesn't have to attack just one drive chain at a time. They can blind merged mine an exit transaction from all of them at once, which means all of the honest miners have to validate all of the chains to keep them all safe. Which, like I said earlier, it just feels like to me we're just moving the validation problem to a different place and thinking that because we've segmented it out a little bit that we've solved the issue, but I don't think we have. And I also want to caveat that I still might be missing some of the pieces. One of the things I tried to make very clear in the BitMEX drive chain read and that episode and a couple of episodes since is that I'm still open to this. I'm still interested in this discussion. That's why I'm doing episodes on all this shit. We've been reading about sidechains for like 6 episodes. So anyway, we'll reference this piece again probably tomorrow when we dig into Alex's piece that's the latest in the thread, and we'll see if this keeps coming. If people keep making articles responding to Alex and Fiat Jaff again, if they're good, maybe we'll just keep going down this rabbit hole. I mean, You know, this is why I think the scaling debate and the block size war was such a prominent part of Bitcoin's history in such an important era, is because it was the recognition of the limitations. It was the full admission that, okay, the blockchain doesn't scale. We've known it. You know, it's not like Hal Finney didn't blurt this. Like, this wasn't the absolute very beginning of the discussion about Bitcoin, like day one. But honestly, a lot of pieces that are falling into place have me really hopeful. And it's actually not all on Bitcoin that has me excited. It's one of the things that has me, I'll tell you a couple of genuine, simple incentive and technological pieces of the puzzle that I think will lead us in the right direction, purely for the sake of saving money and trying to individually get the best security we can get out of Bitcoin. And I'm sure, like all times in history, and what I think is just kind of a natural progression of things, is that we go two steps forward, one step back. Is I think Bitcoin, due to the native limitations of how this consensus technology works and the unavoidable, inescapable limitations of bandwidth and volume for achieving the security, the system and the game theory that it achieves, we will have a one step back. I think this is the natural one step back, is the limitation of knowing that we have a scaling cap, that there is a wall that is going to be very difficult to break through. But I do not think that it is something inherently we cannot break through. I think it's just not an easy fix. But the things that actually have me most excited about decentralizing, ensuring decentralized Bitcoin into the future, and the fact that as many people as possible can actually achieve quote-unquote on-chain security, are one, the incredible compression, data compression power of CoinJoin, CTV, and Taproot. Two, the new coordination protocols that are federated, relay-based, and peer-to-peer, like Holepunch, Valid, Nostr, obviously, and Fedimint. And I don't mean that purely in the Fedimint sidechain idea. I mean it in the actual, like, coordinating multiple members of the Federation, because they're actually applying it to AI and resource sharing on top of the fact that they can just run eCash. That's actually not just the thing that they do with it. What they actually figured out a way to do is solve a really kind of complicated coordination problem between a bunch of these different entities, and they're using it for other things. I'm actually trying to, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot to refresh that. I was going to get Obi on, Obi Nwosu on AI Unchained, and I got to remember to go back and message him. We literally paused that right in the middle of our conversation. I'm glad I brought that up, because I had completely slipped my mind. But essentially, these elements, I think, lead to community-based, non-centralized coordination of massive batching efforts. Keet with big rooms is about to be able to handle thousands, tens of thousands of users. And there's just so much, and regardless of what you think about, like, whether or not the peer-to-peer model is going to work or the relay model is necessarily going to be better, I don't think it even matters. I think we're seeing so much development on that front that coordination among thousands of participants is going to be possible without centralized entities and without centralized identity. I think this is a powerful piece of the puzzle of how to achieve as much security for each of those individuals in as trust-minimized a relationship, or more importantly, as locally trusted of a relationship, so that you know who you're interacting with and it's not some just giant faceless corporation or some government that is giving you that cost savings, or just making that sort of service available to you. And then there's CISA, the cross-input signature aggregation, which, you know, just the next step of Schnorr signatures. And then lastly, I think, simply put, the space of what we can do with the technology we have, with the tools that we have available to us, both in Bitcoin and outside of Bitcoin, has barely been scratched. I genuinely think that the very idea of thinking like Bitcoin, of thinking in the idea of game theory, of economic or probabilistic finality, is a door we've just barely opened. And considering it took us 20 to 30 years to solve the Bitcoin problem, I genuinely think we can solve, now that we've, the consensus problem, I think, is actually the more difficult problem. And while drive chains, I think, are a very interesting player, I do not think it's the magic bullet, but I do think that we can solve this problem. So anyway, maybe at this point I'm just being kind of a little hopeful and a little bit romantic about it, but we'll go ahead and close this out. I need to pay a little attention. What's up, Rad? How you doing, buddy? So we will shift this over and continue the conversation with Alex's piece tomorrow. So thank you guys so much for listening. Mad respect to Fiat Jaff. Really actually happy to hear his thoughts on this topic. And I always appreciate an unapologetic voice, especially the ones that I disagree with. I really do. So just want to tip my hat and say respect. And I will catch you guys on the next episode. Don't forget to check out our amazing sponsors, nodeless.io/guy, or well, bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless. The link is right there in the show notes. Again, if you set up a donation page, I'll shoot you 10,000 sats. Send me the link. CoinKite and the cold card for keeping my Bitcoin safe. Thank you. And 9% off for you guys with code BitcoinAudible. And Fold gets you sats back on all of your fiat life. If you're stuck still having to use fiat, and you're not getting paid sats, you're doing it wrong. Links will be right there in the show notes. And I will catch you guys on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. One of the sad signs of our times is that we have demonized those who produce, subsidized those who refuse to produce, and canonized those who complain. Thomas Sowell.